The Guardian.
Hello, this is Lindsay Irvin for The Guardian Books Podcast. The cliche is that there are no second acts in American lives, but James Frey appears to be moving into something like his fourth. After nearly destroying himself with drink and drugs as a young man, Frey managed to beat his vices and wrote A Million Little Pieces, a searing story of his own addiction for which he won huge acclaim. Then, the book, sold as memoir, was revealed to contain fabricated stories, and Frey became a notorious figure, hounded out of the country by a venomous media. And now he's back for Act 4, in which he reinvents himself as a great novelist with the newly published Bright, Shiny Morning. Passing through London, Frey came into the Guardian studio, where he began by explaining that he never meant to be anything other than a novelist.
You know, I can't talk about a lot of that stuff because of legal agreements and restrictions. You know, I wrote a book and my intentions were entirely literary, and I took license in the construction of that and composition of that book, and I got in a lot of trouble for it.
So, but you had always set out to be a novelist.
Yeah, I set out to be a novelist, but even that is almost irrelevant to me, you know? I'm a writer. I write books. I don't care what labels publishers stick on the side of them. It's meaningless, you know? I think we're moving, though it's always been done, we're moving even more into an age where we're seeing some blend of fact and fiction, and people are creating and making books that sort of defy easy categorization, and I'm definitely doing that very, very deliberately.
Yes, although, I mean, that book was at the beginning of the trend which now sees most of Britain's high street bookshops, and presumably it's the same in the States, having a section devoted to troubled lives and factual stories of struggle and suffering and redemption. Do you have a sense of where that appetite stems from?
You know, people try to read things that relate to their own lives, and, you know, everybody wants to read something that's going to make them feel better about their own life and feel like there's hope in their own life and feel like they have a chance in their own life. I think that probably has a lot to do with it. You know, also, you know, misery loves company, so I guess enjoyable in some perverse way to read about other people's misery. You know, it'll be a happy day when the trend is over, for sure.
I was wondering whether the horrendous fallout from the first memoir, which saw you dragged up before the court of Oprah Winfrey and so on, whether that fueled your ambitions for this book.
Not really, you know. I've always wanted to write big, ambitious, sort of interesting new books. And I think that whole situation probably made this book better because I had more to prove again. But I had planned on writing this book before that whole mess became a mess, and I stuck to my plan.
Yeah, because, I mean, it's a very grand sort of story. And were you consciously squaring up to the tradition of the great American novel?
Absolutely. You know, I think that's the shot you have to take if you want to be a serious writer in America. You know, people tend to shy away from it now because the term the great American novel has almost become a joke. But, you know, it's what I tried to do, for sure. You know, the best, most important, most meaningful writers have all tried to do it. And this was my first shot at it. You know, I'll probably take more.
Yeah. So your models in this instance were?
You know, I mean, the model was Mailer or Tom Wolfe or Ernest Hemingway or F. Scott Fitzgerald, Kerouac, you know, Bret Easton Ellis. I thought American Psycho was, in an odd way, taking a shot at that same thing. I hope at some point to be placed in the canon among those people. We'll see if it happens.
And how did you come to settle on Los Angeles as your subject, which is, I mean, it's very much a sort of cross-section of American life, but it's very centrally focused on Los Angeles.
I lived in L.A. for 8 years, and it's a place I loved, and it's a city I think is an amazing place. You know, I think there have been a lot of books written about many of the great cities of the world where the city itself is a central character. You know, it's been done with Paris and Rome and Moscow. It's been done many times with London and New York, and nobody had ever tried it with Los Angeles. And I thought it was, you know, it was due. It's also an amazing sort of canvas to work with. You know, L.A. is the fastest growing city in America, the most diverse city in America. In many ways, I think it's the city that's most representative of America in the 21st century. And there was a ton of material to work with.
A rather scary, as you describe it, quite a scary, vast thing to square up to.
Yeah, I mean, L.A.'s gigantic, you know. I mean, I've been driving around London the last day or so, and London's pretty gigantic, but L.A. is huge, and there are huge chunks of L.A. that haven't even been developed yet, but it just keeps growing and growing. Immigration has not slowed at all. You know, in 30 years, it'll probably be the biggest city in the country.
So, matching that, there is an enormous cast of characters in this novel, but with five central characters who seem to very clearly represent the different kinds of dreams animating the life of that city. I wondered, did you worry about making them individuals rather than sort of emblematic types?
I sort of wanted them to be both. I wanted them to be individuals, and they were also sort of archetypes of people and places and cultures that exist in the city that are very exemplary of the city. You know, you make, hopefully I made them individuals, but that's just in the details and the telling of the stories. The sun rises in a clear sky that moves from black to gray to white to deep, pure crystal blue. One in Georgia packs his things, he's going to take a bus. Four in Mexico walk across scorched earth, water and packs on their back. Two in Indiana, best friends coming together, they pack their best clothes while their parents wait to take them to the airport. One in Canada drives south. 60 from China in a cargo container sail east. Four in New York pool their cash and buy a car and drop out of school and drive west. 16 cars of a passenger train crossing the Mojave, only one stop left. One in Miami doesn't know how she's going to get there. Three in Montana have a truck. None of them have any idea what they're going to do once they arrive. A plane from Brazil sold out, landing at LAX. Six in Chicago dreaming on shared stages. They rent a van to see if any of them can make it. Two from Arizona hitchhiking. Four more just crossed in Texas walking. Another one in Ohio with a motorcycle and a dream. All of them with their dreams. It calls to them and they believe it and they cannot say no to it. They cannot say no. It calls to them. It calls. Calls.
There's a very stern notice at the beginning of the book that nothing in this book should be considered accurate or reliable. But alongside the obviously invented stories, there's also vast quantity of what seems to be factual information about the city. How much, I wonder, can the reader rely on?
It doesn't matter, you know. Theoretically, it's a novel, so it can all be made up. It's not, you know.
It is presented in a way that does very much suggest that it's factual information because the dates and...
Most of it is factual information, probably 75 to 85% of it's factual information. But that was a very, very deliberate blurring of the line between what's fact, what's fiction, and does it even matter? You know, I've gotten in a lot of trouble for that in the past. And that... disclaimer was sort of a statement of defiance.
Right, so it was deliberately provocative.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's me saying, I'm going to do what I want, I'm going to do it how I want it, and you might have a problem with it, and that's your problem, you know? I very, very consciously wanted to blur that line and wanted to provoke people with that. And not only that disclaimer at the beginning of the book, but the way some of these so-called facts are in fact not facts at all, and some of the things that are presented as facts that might seem ridiculous or invented are in fact real.
Are there any clues as to how we can, as readers, we can tell the difference between those, or is it you just want people to be suspicious of everything?
You can spend endless hours Googling things if you want. I mean, one of the funny things is the U.S. publisher, you know, the United States is such a litigious country. the U.S. publisher was very, very, very careful with how they vetted this book before it was published. So I had to write a document that ended up being 40 pages long that was going through the book and very precisely telling them which facts were real and where I got them and which facts were invented. By the end of the document, I was just so annoyed with having to do it that it was just like, I can't say what I was writing.
But presumably now everybody's ready for the next lawsuit, should one arrive.
There shouldn't be. But if there are, you know.
What led you to run those two threads through the books of obviously invented stories and what appears to be factual, other than just sort of provoking your critics? Why did you want to match those two, put those two strands together?
You know, because in many ways the central character of the book is the city of L.A., which I think is this very unusual, very unique place. And it's become what it is because of its history, which is not necessarily normal. You know, most cities have a sustainable water source and they grow outward from that source. L.A. has no sustainable water source and it did not grow outward. It grew, you know, it was essentially 100 or so little places that grew together over time as they all expanded. And they ultimately grew together because of water. There are a lot of other sort of odd historical things. You know, L.A. used to provide almost a quarter of the world's oil supply. And
good Lord, I didn't know that.
Yeah, until 1935. And it also had the world's largest public rail system. And the oil companies, you know, pressured the government to tear it out because on the basis of, well, we make oil. Oil's needed for cars. We're a big part of the economy. You should support our business by, you know, incenting people to use cars. And that's why L.A. now has this ridiculously large highway system and has more cars in it than any other city in the world. I think 27 million cars in Los Angeles. You know, there are a lot of weird things like that that have made the city what it is today. And I thought it was important for people to know, if they were going to know what this place is and why it is, to have a history.
We do see in the city a place that which draws in American dreamers of many different kinds, with many different kinds of dreams, and basically chews them up. Is it a city that you have some fondness for?
Yeah, I love L.A., you know. L.A.'s gnarly. Gnarly is this word, I guess you maybe don't use it here. In America, that can mean like 20 different things, depending on the inflection. So when I say it's gnarly, it's a good thing. Meaning like cool, big, awesome, cool. So
lots of different things to like.
Lots, yeah. But
and a fair few to feel some horror at, presumably.
Sure, but that's the case in any big city, you know. Every city has its has things about it that are great and things about it that are terrible. L.A. draws people and chews them up, but it draws people from all over the world and chews them up. And it draws people from all over the world and provides them with opportunities that don't exist anywhere else. And it provides them with the chance to take advantage of those opportunities. It provides them with the chance for lives that they wouldn't be able to have in any other city in the world. You know, people do go there and things happen for them.
Was it somewhere that enabled you to sort of invent yourself?
I mean, I moved out.
And kind of semi-destroy yourself as well.
If you want to think of it that way. I mean, I moved out there when I was 25 or so to try to write movies. And I ended up working as a screenwriter, sort of a journeyman screenwriter in L.A. And being able to do that allowed me to write my book, my first book. You know, I had a tough time a couple of years ago. Have I been destroyed? I don't think so, you know.
No, I guess you came to the brink rather, didn't you?
You know, I had a bad couple months at work, you know. Everybody has good times at their job and bad times at their job. Mine just happened to be much more public than most other people's.
I do wonder your experiences at the hand of the media in the last few years do seem to offer the material for a very fascinating memoir. Presumably that's not in your plans as something to write.
I certainly wouldn't write one, you know. If I did write one, which I highly doubt I ever will, it wouldn't be conventional in any sense. And there would be a lot of sort of games in it if I did, you know, games as to, you know, playing with fact and fiction and what those things are and if it even matters. I mean, I've thought about writing another memoir that is perfectly factually, sourceably accurate and then just publishing it as fiction, just to do the opposite, you know. I don't think any of that stuff matters, you know. I think if you look at most best-selling memoirs in America, you know, frankly, it's been proven, you're going to find that they have many of the same issues in them as mine do. And any book published with a disclaimer in the front is basically saying this book has the same issues his did. Mine just happened to be the most public.
Thank you very much indeed, James Frey.
Thank you.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.